This is The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in today. While we're broadcasting this hour, let's talk online. We're live tweeting at KUOW. Topic number one today, President Trump is building walls. He's got plans to build a literal wall along the southern border and deport millions of undocumented people. He's issued a travel ban aimed at seven majority Muslim countries that he says pose a terrorism risk. We'll talk with three Iranian Americans about that one in just a few minutes. But now there are signs of a reverse effect, that the United States is being walled off from abroad. College recruiters say international students now express fear about coming to America. KUOW's David Hyde reports.
Job Korb-Nice recruits international students for Seattle Pacific University, and he says something unusual happened on his most recent trip. Almost every student wanted to talk about politics.
The icebreaker conversation was mostly comments about, what do you think of Trump? And are you happy with him as your president?
Then he said the conversation quickly moved to,
what is Trump doing with the immigration executive orders? And then students are very interested in my perspective on whether they will be safe in the U.S. So our conversations are much about, can I come to the U.S.? Should I come to the U.S.? Will I be safe in the U.S.?
But the other odd thing is, Korb-Nice wasn't on a recruiting trip to one of the seven banned countries. He wasn't even in the Middle East. He was in Norway. Jean-Darc Campbell runs the International Student Recruiting Program at Bellevue College. He's been hearing very similar things from international students.
There is a fear. It's more fear that foreigners are not welcome to the United States. So I think that is a message.
Campbell says he and other recruiters are hearing this from students all over the world, including Japan, which has been a close ally of the United States. Gene Baker has had similar experiences as a recruiter for South Seattle College.
Because of the political environment here, yeah, they are concerned.
Baker's not talking about any of the seven banned countries either. He recently returned from a recruiting trip to China, Vietnam, and Indonesia.
They do voice their concern. And we are a little bit concerned about that, too, because I'm sure it will affect our enrollment numbers.
Nobody knows exactly how student enrollment to the United States could be affected, but some of the numbers coming into the region this winter are suggestive. The University of Washington saw a 7% drop in applications from Chinese students compared to last year, and the University of British Columbia reported a 14% increase. Of course, there are many factors that could explain those differences. It's not at all clear if it has anything to do with the presidential race, when we did hear a lot of this.
China. 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 China.
China. China. China. China.
Esther Brimmer is executive director for the Association of International Educators. She says the reality is some international students are now asking,
will they be next? They are not from one of the seven countries currently on the list in the executive order, but they have a deep sense of concern and unease. The arbitrary way in which this executive order was issued without any real review means that there's real uncertainty among students who are concerned that their country could be the next one on the list.
Brimmer also worries this could mean a big drop in international student applications next year. But should Washingtonians care about that?
In Washington state, $825 million of financial contributions come from international students and their families. That means nearly 8,000 jobs.
Ann Brimmer says some of that money also helps subsidize tuition costs for in-state students. In Seattle, I'm David Hyde, KUOW News.
Now let's get some more local reaction to President Trump's executive order limiting travel from those seven majority Muslim countries that he says pose a terrorism risk. For at least the next 4 months, no one from Iran, for example, will be able to enter the United States. And today we're going to hear how three members of the local Iranian community feel about that ban. Omid Bagheri came to the U.S. at age 5. He's a faculty member at the University of Washington School of Public Health. Hossein Karam's lived in the U.S. since 1979. He's a real estate developer in Bellevue and a state party delegate for Donald Trump. And Arshia Chimak came to the U.S. from Iran 10 years ago on a student visa. She's now a PhD candidate in mechanical engineering at the University of Washington.
Let me give you a context of how I got here. I came to the U.S. on a single entry visa For those people who don't know, it means that whenever I exit America, I have to apply for a new visa. And getting a visa as an Iranian citizen is very difficult. And it costs a lot. We don't have a U.S. embassy in Iran, so people have to travel to different countries to get visas. So as a student here on an F1 visa, on a single entry visa, I was not able to go home very often. Within the last 10 years, I've only been home twice. My dad passed away last year during the quarter, and I was just not able to go back home because the visa process takes a few weeks. I can't afford to lose my job. So this has affected us quite a bit already. And with this ban, that means my family can't come to visit me. A lot of Iranians who are students have been enrolled in the best universities in the U.S. can't come. The applications are done.
How does your employment situation change, possibly because of this, as far as we know, temporary travel ban?
I'm hoping to graduate this year. And given the ban, I'm not going to be able to change my visa from a student visa to a work visa. The details are still coming out, so we don't know exactly how this is going to affect the process. But even talking with the companies right now, they're not sure if they would want to hire an Iranian citizen because my job requires me to travel quite a bit to Europe, to Canada, to Mexico, to Brazil. And it would be impossible to travel outside of the U.S. if the ban is still there.
Hossein, you've just heard some personal stories. You know, most terrorists in the U.S. since 9/11 have been American citizens or legal residents and none from the countries that the president is targeting. So why? What makes you think that any gain in safety, if any, matters more than the vast majority of travelers?
Well, it really tears my heart apart when I hear these sad stories, and my hearts go to them. I do understand it. I was a refugee when we came to this country, my family were, and we went through the same situation.
This was in the late 70s.
Late 70s. Jimmy Carter actually put a stop into the Iranians who had actually fled tyranny. And in his thought, he was trying to punish the regime of Islamic Republic by giving the Iranian citizens a hard time back then. And we were the victims. We were escaping tyranny. We had no relation to them. So I feel for this because it happened to me. On the flip side, President Trump made a commitment as a candidate, Trump, to protect America and America is first. And he did just that. He is not at fault. The people who are portraying violence into the United States, those are the fault. And our president did the right thing by standing up and making a pause. This is not a ban. This is a pause to look at our policies, which are totally inefficient and inadequate at this time, to make sure that you and me are protected against terror. And this is one of the reasons that I proposed to the transition team that we need to have community engagement. Community outreach is an important part of the vetting process, in my view. What I mean is, once you have the communities involved and the communities look into their own citizens and try to detect suspicious behavior or behaviors that is not consistent with U.S. interests, to report them to the authority, FBI, Homeland Security. By doing that, there's less emphasis on the law enforcement and that there's a lot better human intelligence. So if once we take that would be one step that I think we must take. By doing that, I think we can bring some calm and remove some of the fears that these people who are planning to come or are already here, they're good people and those you can trust. And the ones who are not good people, then we should identify them.
Arshia, what do you think of the idea that the Iranian-American community needs to do more to monitor their own community?
I think it's definitely a good idea. I also think that, just going back to what Hossein was saying, I think we should pay attention to who is coming to the U.S. Every year, about 1,000 Iranian students come, the best of the best, come to the U.S. to go to schools, to the top schools, MIT, Harvard, Stanford, any university that you call it, University of Washington. And these students are the best of the best. They make the next CEOs. They make founders, CTOs, COOs of Expedia, Twitter, Google, you name it. And without having, with just calling Iranians terrorists, by just, we are destroying our Iranian community. There are 21,000 Iranian citizens who live in Washington, the state of Washington. And when people are degraded like that, when we are treated like that, when we're banned to enter the country, when our families are banned to enter the country, all these talents won't take it anymore. How much more can we take? We would want to move to other countries who respect us, who are willing to have us, who are excited to have us. So I think U.S. is going to see a big effect because of this. U.S. is going to lose a lot of talent and highly skilled workers.
Hossein, what about the theory that this moves like this travel ban inspire more enemies and enmity than it could ever defend against terrorists?
Well, there's an argument to be made, but I think this is not a ban. This is a pause. And the purpose of the pause is to evaluate our security policies and vetting policies. And as long as we keep it in a short, defined timetable, I don't think that's going to be the case. I think the key to this thing would be going through some of the weaknesses and identifying them and engage their community and have them be part of the vetting process so they can look at their newcomers from their own communities and try to make sure that those people are compatible with our Constitution and U.S. laws.
Can I make a point here? So in this executive order that bans these seven countries, in some of the subsections, it says that these foreign countries have to provide some information to the U.S. for this ban to be removed. And we know for the past 40 years, Iran and U.S. have had no communication with each other. So for this to happen, all Iranians are right now thinking that this is a permanent ban, not a short-term ban.
Omid, you said there's a silver lining in the president's travel ban. What did you mean by that?
Well, the silver lining is two parts. The silver lining is that we can now see our society for what it actually is, and that all of this is possible because of structural racism and all these other oppressions that have been in place that have been used to reach the point we are. In that thread, we have had many people become energized and be able to have that clarity and understand all of these things that are in place. And what we're seeing around the country is a lot of energy being put into that. And the historical context is lacking. I think even in this conversation, we're really missing the fact that this argument of doing this for national security has been something that has been said time and time again. It's what President Roosevelt said when he signed an executive order that put Japanese-American U.S. citizens into concentration camps for the same exact argument. And every time we have done this, every time there have been a question of bringing refugees, we always say, okay, never again, never again. And then it takes long enough for us to completely forget about that, and we lose that context and how all these things are connected to a pattern. They're connected to each other. And that context is important for us to really understand, have a deeper understanding of what's happening right now, and how to really move forward without pretty much repeating history and doing the same exact things and then being shocked and surprised when it happens again.
Arshia, how does the president's travel ban make you feel about the country you've lived in for the last decade, the United States?
I want to separate American government from American people. Because my boyfriend is American, my best friends, my closest people in my life right now are American. I also have seen the support from all American strangers that supported me through this hard time. So,
what kind of support have you seen from strangers?
We had a forum at the university yesterday when we talked about the visa ban, and people shared their stories with us. And the majority of people were American. They were there to support us. They were here. They were creating a support group for people who are impacted by this. They extended their arms to help people who were banned and couldn't come to the U.S. to walk their dogs, take care of their plants, pay for their rent. So I'm talking about those American people, American students, who are very helpful and very nice. But I'm going to say that I'm very disappointed in the system that I trusted 10 years ago to come to this country, to get a very good education and build my future just like Hossein and Omid. And I think this system is failing me right now, but I believe also that the other part of this system is strong and it's empowering and it's gonna get us back to where we were, back to the equilibrium.
Arshia Chima, PhD candidate at the University of Washington. Also, Omid Bagheri is a UW faculty member. Hossein Karam is a real estate developer in Bellevue. And these stories came to us from KUOW's immigration team, which is exploring the effect of the Trump administration on the lives of immigrants and refugees living in the Puget Sound region. You can hear more stories and you can share your thoughts at KUOW.org. We're live tweeting this program at KUOW. You can email us. The email address is record@KUOW.org and leave us a voicemail anytime, 206-221-3663. Again, 221-3663. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. We live inside our bubbles. We don't have to talk to people who are different from us because it's so easy to avoid them. So, to push against our bubble walls, KUOW is launching a new series of conversations between people who might otherwise not speak to one another. Here to explain is KUOW's executive producer for community engagement, Ross Reynolds. Hey, Ross.
Thanks.
This idea started with a single event that community engagement did last year. It was called Ask a Muslim. What was the thinking behind that original event?
Well, let's go back to just about a year ago when then-candidate Trump started talking about a ban on Muslims coming into the country. And it occurred to me that how many of us actually know Muslims in our everyday life that we could talk about with this? And even if we know them, they might be people we work with or they might be people who are clients of ours. We might not feel comfortable talking about religion or politics. So I thought, let's just set up a situation where you could sit down and talk to not one Muslim, but say 6 or 8 or 12 Muslims in a speed dating format and find out what they're about. So we did it, and there was a really good feeling from that.
And hopefully there's less pressure about asking the wrong question, you know, in that welcoming format.
Yes, we're trying to make it a welcoming format, a civil format.
And what worked about the Ask a Muslim event?
I think what worked was the fact that these were spontaneous conversations with people that you didn't know. Sometimes when you have conversations with people you do know, there are a lot of assumptions going on. So I thought the stranger aspect of it was really great.
So what can we expect from the new season of asking events?
Bigger, better.
More asking.
More asking. More people will be asking. We're going to have Ask a Trump supporter. We're going to have Ask a transgender person, Ask a cop, another Ask a Muslim. We're also going to have Ask an Immigrant, and we're going to leave one of these open because as news develops over the course of the next 6 or 8 months, there might be another misunderstood group that we're hearing news about that would be good to connect.
And how do you find out the impact that these events have, if they do have an impact?
Well, it had a great feeling to it, but you're right. We don't really know what the impact was. So this time, one of the things that we're doing is we're going to be doing surveys before, after, and then 3 months after the event and asking people some neutral questions. We're working with a sociologist on this. So we'd like to actually maybe even have a published paper which demonstrates that this either works or doesn't work. It feels good, but we want to know that it has impact.
You're also asking listeners who else we could ask, right?
That's right. We like to find out how many other permutations of this we could do. They're just infinite. There are so many different ways we could go with this. Ask a vet, ask an evangelical Christian, ask a homeless person. So if the method works and if we're able to perfect it, I think it can go a long way. Also, we don't think it's something that KUOW alone has to do. Part of this project is going to be to build a toolkit online that's attractive and useful so that if you get the idea of, hey, I'd like to do that in my community, you could just go online and get the help and support to do that.
Now, Ross, we both know that sometimes conversations like this could get touchy, you know? I mean, I'm thinking an Ask a Trump supporter event and others. How do you handle a possible tension?
Well, we're going to have to emphasize to people it's Ask a Trump supporter. It's not convince a Trump supporter. It's not harangue a Trump supporter.
Right.
And also, I want to train people in the things that you and I do every day. It really is almost an interview situation. And having asked a lot of the wrong questions over my many years of interviewing, I know what they are. And I think I can help direct people to be asking neutral questions to get the best out of this conversation.
That's KUOW's executive producer for community engagement, Ross Reynolds. Ross, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
And if you want to find out more or sign up to come to an event, We're tweeting out a link right now. You don't even have to ask. We're just tweeting it out right now at KUOW. It's The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. News and information. The financial services industry is hopeful right now that President Trump is going to delay, maybe even overturn, an investor protection rule that the Obama White House put in place. The rule requires that financial advisors act in their clients' best interest when it comes to their retirement accounts. It's gotten a lot of support from consumer groups and unions and financial watchdogs, but the financial industry lobbied against the rule, saying it was going to have unintended consequences and create too much paperwork to make it worth it for advisors to work with small clients. We will lay this issue out later this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. I hope you can tune in. KUOW 94.9 Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. All of us need somebody to look up to. That's what motivated Marlo Mack to seek out a role model for her 9-year-old transgender daughter. In this excerpt of her podcast, How to Be a Girl, Mack tells the story of finding a big sister for her child.
Just over a year ago, I started asking around in our community to see if anyone knew of a young transgender woman who might like to be a mentor to my daughter. I wanted someone young because I saw how my daughter idolized the cool college girls who babysat her sometimes.
Oh, she's here!
Catherine!
Hi!
You're here!
And I wanted someone fairly mature.
I'm getting big.
Or at least old enough to feel okay about being needed for a while.
Catherine, look at this!
Yeah, what's that?
Catherine was 25 years old, and she was perfect.
And can I tell you how rare this is?
She even had the right hair.
How rare is that?
Super rare.
The hair my daughter dreams of having.
Wait, oh my God. So your hair is so long.
Long and dark and wavy. It was love at first sight.
I got the 5-story.
Catherine had a good job at a bank.
That's dope.
Her own apartment downtown. And even a handsome boyfriend.
You want a room in that awesome house?
Yeah, I got it.
She started coming over for dinner.
Ingredients for cookies.
Or we'd all go out for pizza.
You guys want to make some cookies?
Sure.
She joined us on Halloween to go trick-or-treating around our neighborhood. Catherine became part of our world.
Yeah, sure, of course.
The role model I'd been hoping to find for my daughter.
I don't think we've seen you since your surgery.
And she was going through a lot of change, too.
Have I not come back since?
What surgery?
Preheat oven at 375.
Okay.
How much do we need?
Yeah, so we need two folds.
When I watch my daughter with Catherine, I get the feeling that I'm doing something right.
Okay.
I have to stifle the urge to spell out my intentions, to say to my daughter, look, sweetheart, she's like you. Someday, that could be you. Because if this is working,
Mom, just leave them.
It's not going to be because of anything I say.
Shoo, shoo.
Okay, so now we need...
So how are you feeling post-op? How are you feeling since the surgery?
I love my vagina. I really do. Oh, like, I really do. Like, she's still healing, like...
Is she?
But, like, I went well, and it's like, yeah. She's cute. I'm excited. I'm excited for the future. I love the fact that, you know, I'm a 27-year-old trans woman, and I have my own little office at work. Like, I have my name on the door. Like, I want to find my future husband and stuff like that. But,
yeah,
you know, until that happens, like, I need to focus on my own self because...
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, in the words of RuPaul, if you can't love yourself, how in the hell are you going to love anyone else? You know?
Nice.
That's so true. Now we're going to mix the fun stuff, okay?
Yeah.
Yay.
My daughter, of course, knows that Catherine is trans.
Go wash your hands.
But I have no idea how much she thinks about it or exactly what it might mean to her.
Do we have one of those things that makes it so there are no lumps in the flower?
She's too busy having fun.
Mix it in there, Mark, girl.
Mm-hmm.
Don't give me attitude, girl. I see that face.
One thing I know she doesn't understand yet is how different things have been for Catherine.
Don't even play. I am 20 years older than you.
Yeah. This was an excerpt of the podcast, How to Be a Girl, hosted by Marlo Mack. It's a collaboration with KUOW. You can listen to the entire episode. You can subscribe to How to Be a Girl wherever you get your podcasts. It's The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle, news and information. I'm Bill Radke. This month marks the 75th anniversary of an executive order signed by President Franklin Roosevelt. The order moved 120,000 Japanese Americans from their homes into incarceration camps. The executive order lasted until the end of World War II, and for the most part, the Japanese detainees cooperated. But some of them resisted, including a group of young men at the Heart Mountain internment camp in Wyoming. Seattle-based film director Frank Abbe made a documentary about that group of resistors. It's called Conscience and the Constitution. Abbe told me who those young men were and how he is connected to them.
Well, these are 63 young men who refused induction into the armed forces of the United States until their rights were first restored and their parents were released from an American concentration camp. This was the last hitch upon which they could hang a test case against the U.S. government. This resistance was, you know, they were labeled draft dodgers or draft delinquents at the time, but young men who were perfectly willing to fight in World War II along with their other Nisei brothers. But their principals called for them to resist the draft as a belated protest against the wartime eviction of all Japanese Americans from the West Coast, including Seattle. So, you know, as you know, 7,000 Japanese Americans from Seattle, 10,000 from Washington State, evicted from their homes here in Seattle and Washington State and the West Coast, solely on the basis of race, because they looked like the Japanese enemy that had attacked Pearl Harbor.
You know, when I think of the Japanese American incarceration, I don't picture resistance for some reason.
And neither did my community. I grew up, my generation grew up, believing that our only response to this wartime injustice, this massive violation of civil rights, was twofold. Contained in two phrases. One was shikateganai, which is Japanese for it can't be helped, passive resignation in the face of injustice. The second was go for broke, patriotic self-sacrifice, spilling one's blood for America to prove your loyalty to the U.S. And that never rang true to me as a young person growing up in the 60s. And we'd go to our parents and say, Mom, Dad, why didn't you resist? And they'd pat us on the head and say, well, you're too young. You weren't born yet. You can't apply your Berkeley civil rights activism to the 1940s. You can't judge us. And then when I discovered the existence of these draft resistors inside an American concentration camp, that was to me the missing link. It was proof that the Constitution did exist in the 1940s, and that we weren't, you know, a young generation imagining principled civil disobedience in the face of this massive injustice.
Didn't you find out that even your father somewhat resisted at the time?
That was a big surprise to me. My father was an eighth grade, you know, a really relatively uneducated, he's a Japanese gardener in San Jose, California. And in camp, he wanted to be a cook, and he's peeling potatoes. Some guys came by and says, hey, George, you want to donate $2 to the Fair Play Committee? And he said, sure.
The Fair Play Committee was the...
It was the umbrella for the draft resistance in camp. In all, 63 young men refused induction, refused to board a bus for the draft physical as a means of protesting their incarceration. They were tried and convicted by a judge, federal judge. Then later, the seven leaders of the Fair Play Committee were tried for conspiracy to counsel draft evasion, and they were also convicted and sentenced, along with a journalist, James Omura from Bainbridge Island, who was acquitted on the basis of the First Amendment.
So your dad donated a couple of bucks? That was his resistance?
$2 was a lot of money in those days.
Mm. What did you think of that?
I was pleased that I had something in my history to support my activism. You know, one never knows how these things condition you. I mean, my father never talked about camp at all, like all Japanese American fathers. But it was...
Is that especially a Japanese American thing to not tell a story like that?
Hard to say. I mean, there's nothing cultural about feeling ashamed about going to prison. And the sense among all Japanese Americans was they must have done something wrong to be kicked out of your homes and imprisoned for an average of 4 years. Now we know that it was the government that was wrong in applying race as the sole basis for this mass eviction and recognizing, you know, decades later, the unconstitutionality of this action.
Did these resistors have much of an effect? I mean, just the Heart Mountain, for example, there were thousands of people there.
10,000.
So what impact could a small group of resistors have?
Only in looking back in the rearview mirror do we see the value of protest and resistance. At the time, they were marginalized by the Japanese American Citizens League, which actively suppressed the resistance. JACL was a hyper-patriotic organization inside the community before the war and during the camps, advocating for collaboration, cooperation with incarceration and assimilation after the war in hopes of, you know, avoiding a repeat of this kind of segregation and exclusion. JACL, in my view, sold out Japanese America at the most critical moment in 1942 when the government began making noises about evicting Japanese aliens, my grandparents' generation, people who were ineligible for citizenship to begin with because of racial exclusion laws.
The Issei,
exactly. The JACL informed, after Pearl Harbor, the JACL, in order to demonstrate the loyalty of Japanese Americans, chose to demonstrate their loyalty by informing on the Issei leaders of the community, giving the names to the FBI, leading to the removal of the Japanese American leadership here in Seattle and West Coast cities, and the elevation of the JACL, the Nisei, to the position of, you know, quasi-authority of they became the de facto spokesman for the community.
Nisei being the second generation.
Second generation. I'm Sansei, third generation. Mine is not a popular view even today within the Japanese American community, but the record is clear.
How are you thinking about the Japanese American incarceration and resistance today, Frank?
It is both appalling and pleasing that my film, Conscience and the Constitution, and the idea of resistance is once again in the air. I mean, the resistance is now a thing, right? And I'm pleased that people are, you know, picking up on the film again, but I'm aghast that it's come to this. The Japanese American draft resistors acted, you know, 2 years after the initial eviction. They, as I said, the JACL undercut any chance for resistance at the time of eviction in April 1942 from Seattle and the West Coast. The JACL, Mike Masaoka, openly waived the civil rights of all Japanese Americans by saying, you know, it's wrong for us to contest the legality of this. Let's go into the camps voluntarily. Let's cooperate with the government as a means of avoiding bloodshed in the streets. We don't want tanks in the streets. And as a means of securing good treatment for our people inside these camps, these concentration camps. My hope is that I'm pleased that now resistance is not waiting 2 years until we see the exclusion of the Muslim American community or the marginalization of all immigrant communities.
Well, how can that resistance happen now?
Well, it's happening now. It's happening. We've seen the Women's March, and of course we've seen the march, the blockades at the airports this last weekend. So you know, it's clear that resistance again it's a meme. You know, it's a thing. And people are standing up now. One of my favorite signs, Bill, at the airport protest was, you know, they came for the Muslims, and we said, not this time. And so we've learned, you know, most people have learned from our history in 1942 with Japanese Americans. And looking back at the German playbook, the Nazi playbook from 1933, and seeing the signs of an authoritarian regime happening today, I noticed that Reuters news agency, the wire service, is already issuing guidelines to its reporters that here's the ways that you must regard the current administration in the White House, much like you would an authoritarian regime in South America. And here's what we do in South America against authoritarian regimes. So obviously people are awake and aware of what's happening. And it's, I just don't know how it's going to play out.
Do you find that your fellow Japanese Americans are especially, have learned the same lessons you have?
Well, that's been the whole purpose, Bill, of telling the story of the Japanese American incarceration was to establish the history of what happened, to make sure it is documented. And the history and experience of exclusion gives Japanese America a kind of moral authority to speak on this issue and to speak out now on behalf of Muslim Americans and Mexican immigrants and undocumented residents. It also brings a moral responsibility to speak out now at this time when this history is shockingly being repeated.
Frank Abe is the writer, producer, director of the documentary Conscience and the Constitution. It's about Japanese Americans who resisted being drafted into the U.S. military during their incarceration of World War II. He also publishes a blog at resisters.com. That's R-E-S-I-S-T-E-R-S. You're listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle. Now, in Washington, D.C., the White House says it's putting Iran officially on notice. On notice after Iran's missile launch over the weekend. What does on notice mean? We don't know. Are military options on the table? We don't know. This seems to be a pattern in the early Trump administration, coming out with tough words, sometimes before having consulted, sometimes before having decided on a known and clear policy. We'll get into this later today on KUOW's All Things Considered. This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. We're live tweeting the show at KUOW. In Washington State prisons, 85% of the faith-based ministries for inmates are Christian. That's typical in the United States. In fact, if an inmate wants to be involved in anything that is not daily prison life, often their only option is Christian faith-based ministry. Professor Tanya Erzin wanted to know how that came to be and how it's affecting people. She teaches religion and gender studies at the University of Puget Sound. She told me that the rise in Christian ministries is happening in part because public spending on prisons has dropped.
What has stepped in to fill that gap are primarily religious organizations, and they're primarily conservative. But prisons have been religious from the very beginning. The first prisons in Pennsylvania and New York were penitentiaries. They were created by Quakers and Methodists. If you think about that term, penitentiary, to be penitent, they were started by Quakers who believed that they'd put people in individual cells. You would find the inner light within you and that you would be transformed through a relationship with God.
So today's Christian-based programs in a prison, what kind of programs are those typically?
They really vary. So there are major prison ministry organizations. One of the biggest is called Prison Fellowship Ministry, and it was run by and started by Chuck Colson, who went to prison for Watergate-related crimes.
Right.
And became born again. And so he started this organization that operated throughout the country but took over entire wings of prisons. And every prison has a chaplain, and chaplains just historically tend to be Christian, so they can really determine who comes in. So if a chaplain happens to be Southern Baptist in Central Florida, you know, the majority of religious volunteers coming in are going to probably be from that religious background.
And these are not just Bible study programs. This is education assistance and counseling, right? Give us an idea what services these are.
If you think about religious groups come in, they do trauma counseling, they do mental health counseling, they do high school GED, they do college programs, they do things like anger management, but with an evangelical framework. And some of the programs I looked at in the South particularly are the Baptist seminaries have offered the only college degree programs in prisons. So the option is if you want to go to school, you get a degree in Christian ministry, and they then take men and women from those prisons and move them to another prison in the state. So in Texas and Louisiana, there's no shortage of prisons. And the idea is to have them proselytize to other prisoners. They call it moral rehabilitation because they have to avoid the idea that they are proselytizing.
Does an inmate have to say they're Christian to take advantage of this range of programs?
No, legally they can't because that's violating, you know, the First Amendment. But there are very, very few non-Christians in those programs. So when I interviewed people, there were a small handful of Muslims, but most people identify as Christian. Because if you think about it, the bulk of the classes are around, you know, how do you reach someone's heart who's not a Christian, you know, looking specifically an entire class on the book of, you know, studying Jeremiah in the Bible. So, you know, you really have to be motivated to want to get an education if you're not part of that religious tradition.
You mentioned you talked with Muslim inmates. Mm-hmm. What do non-Christian inmates tell you about all of this?
Well, one particularly I talk a lot about in my book, he was in this program in Texas. And he was one of, I think, the only person in his class who was Muslim. And he just said, you know, this is my only, I am a Muslim. They're not going to convert me, but this is the only opportunity I have. And he was so shocked that they let him talk to me. We were in a room with no one else around. You know, obviously there are guards walking around. But he kept saying, are you a church lady? No. Are you a police officer? No. I mean, it took a long time for him to just open up. And then he kept laughing. He kept saying, I'm never allowed to talk about this. He talked about how frustrating it is to feel like you're trying to learn, but there are always people who are not undermining, but challenging your particular beliefs. So, and then in Florida, the Muslim group would meet. They had this giant chapel. It's Central Florida. It's the only air-conditioned building in the entire prison, and you can imagine what it's like there. They sleep in these big open dormitories. This evangelical megachurch had funded, redone the chapel. There was a huge TV screen. There were musical instruments. There was air conditioning. And then the Muslim group was allowed to meet, and it essentially was a glorified broom closet. And the warden at the time said to me, I was just visiting, what do you think? I'm thinking of eliminating recreation time, so time that people can go outside, and requiring people to be in the chapel. There's all of these levels of coercion that happen in prison. And I think when you have limited choices and those are the only choices presented to you, that's what you're going to take advantage of.
What does all this look like here in Washington State prisons?
Washington's interesting for a lot of reasons. They have a lot of faith-based groups, but they're, especially in the women's prison, are really shifting to want professional groups who can do things like addiction and mental health and counseling that aren't coming from a faith-based orientation. One thing I'm really interested in is just how these programs affect women, and I work with women here in Washington. I do a college program. Statistically, I think 93% of women in prison have reported domestic violence, sexual abuse, or violence as a child. And so there's this astronomical amount of women who have some kind of trauma, you know, coupled with whatever got them there. There's a lot of addiction, and there just are not the mental health and other programs to help them. And so still you have religious groups coming in to try and work on things like trauma or dealing with rape or dealing with abuse. And while I think those services are necessary, a lot of them end up being about, well, you know, surrender your problems to Jesus. If you submit to God, if you submit your problems to God, that's how you will get better. And I think there should be other kinds of services and ways in thinking about how to deal with that problem.
We're talking with Professor Tanya Erzin, Associate Professor of Religion, Gender Studies at University of Puget Sound, and we're talking about the predominance of Christian prison ministries in our public prisons. Have we missed talking about the positives of these groups?
Yeah, I think there are, or they wouldn't continue to exist. And someone once posed the question to me, are these ministries just another form of discipline and punishment, or do they provide a lifeline for dignity and transformation for people inside? And I think it's both. I think they do both. I think what they enable for a lot of people is it gives them a sense of belonging and community in prison. Those people I talked about who are serving life, after a while, you have no family visit you. You don't have anybody on the outside. Your whole world is a prison. So if you're part of a faith-based group, you get to meet people coming in who are free people. You develop those relationships. which I think is really important. And I think the prison system is really designed to dehumanize people. So you're called offender or inmate, you know, inmate Radke, instead of your first name or referred to as a person. And in a faith-based group, I think there is a humanizing process that happens because a lot of people feel that they are, especially if they're Christian believers, they feel that they have a personal relationship with God, that God cares about their life, that they're forgiven, that they are, can be redeemed. And that is a real shift from a model that says, you're a horrible person, you committed a crime, you're going to prison for the rest of your life. We forget it, you're incorrigible, as opposed to, we believe that you can be different and that you can be transformed. My criticism is that with so many religious groups and so many prisons who have day-to-day contact with people in prison, and probably know more about people in prison than anyone except people's families, they're the ones who could say, why in Louisiana do so many people get life without parole? Why is this considered a normal sentence? Why are we sending more women to prison than we've ever sent before? Why are we sending a woman with five small children to prison for a nonviolent offense as opposed to another kind of intervention? They have the constituency. They have a mouthpiece to really make, you know, say things broader about changing sentencing and changing the policies and politics around this. But so many of them are focused on individual conversion and not on the broader picture about why is the prison there in the first place and why are there so many people in it? So I think I'm hopeful that religious groups can start to ask those bigger questions.
Finally, Tanya, most people listening to you right now haven't been in prison. Many don't know anybody in prison. Why is this an issue we, the rest of us, should all be thinking about?
Sure. Because the United States is truly exceptional in that we incarcerate more people in proportion to our population than anywhere else in the world. And it's continuing to skyrocket. Here in Washington, just if you're listening, the women's prison is way overcrowded. Women are the fastest growing part of the prison population. And I actually think a lot of people do know and are directly impacted by this because eventually most people get released from prison. They rejoin community. They have to have a job. They have to have housing. And the question I have for people, do you want to have a system in which we're trying to help people to figure out how to transform and change their lives so that when they get out, they can be a full citizen? Or do you want to just warehouse people, astronomical numbers of people who then get out and have mental health problems, lack of education, whose families don't have the resources to succeed? Because I think that harms all of us as a society. And I think it's an ethical and political issue. We have to find a better solution to how we think about punishment.
Associate Professor Tanya Erzin, Religion and Gender Studies at University of Puget Sound. She also heads the Freedom Education Project Puget Sound. It's a college program in the Washington Corrections Center for Women. Her book is called God in Captivity, The Rise of Faith-Based Ministries in an Age of Mass Incarceration, and it comes out early next month. Tanya Erzin is also giving free talks around the state about this as part of the Humanities Washington Speakers Bureau, and we're tweeting out a link with more information now at KUOW. Speaking of prisons, a two-day uprising at a state prison in Delaware has killed one corrections officer and inmates took four guards hostage. We'll have a report on that today on KUOW's All Things Considered. You'll also hear about violent protests last night over a speech at UC Berkeley by Milo Yiannopoulos, the Breitbart editor, who you'll remember also spoke at the University of Washington, where a clash between protesters and supporters got violent. That and more coming up on KUOW's All Things Considered today.